ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this next session, the InfoSecurity Europe Hall of Fame 2017, where we're very pleased to be inducting Professor Mary Akin. My colleague, Eleanor Dalloway, who's the editor and publisher of InfoSecurity Magazine, will be talking to Mary about her career and getting some insight into some of the things that Mary's working on. So without further delay, I'll just hand over straight away to Eleanor.
Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here, and welcome to this year's 2017 Hall of Fame induction. I'm genuinely excited to be able to sit here with Mary and interview her and talk to her about her career, her very impressive career. So today we're going to be recognising Mary's contribution to the information security sector as the world's leading expert in forensic psychology, cyber psychology. Her work as an advocate and educator in information security, and her role in raising the sector's profile. So I'm going to read out a little bit about what her roles are, and this might take a while because she's a very busy lady. So Mary's an associate professor at the University College Dublin, Geary Institute for Public Policy, and academic advisor in psychology to EC3 at Europol. She's a lecturer in criminology and research fellow at the School of Law, Middlesex University, a fellow of the Society for Chartered IT Professionals, we're halfway through, a sense-making fellow at the IBM Network Science Research Centre, and has served as a distinguished professor at the practice of cyber analytics at AIRS. She's a member of the Hague Justice Portal Advisory Board and director of the Cyber Psychology Research Network. And all of this just goes to show just how deserving she is of this induction today. So, Mary, thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
I'd like to start, because we are looking at your career here, with the early days, the school years. And perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what you were passionate about at school and how those interests led you to where you are today.
Well, when I was much younger, I actually used to collect insects. And and effectively, I was fascinated by them. And before everybody starts thinking Hannibal Lecter and moths, the study of entomology is a legitimate study, even for a seven-year-old. And so I was always interested in forensics. And it wasn't until I saw CSI Las Vegas, and we all remember Grisham and his love of insects, where I thought, oh, yes, this is why. So, yeah, I started off with the study of psychology, and then I did my postgrad in forensic psychology, and then I worked in industry for many years in consumer behavioral profiling.
So where did the tech piece come in? And now you've obviously got a huge focus on cybersecurity and just the cyber world generally. When did that come about?
When I was working in industry in the 90s, I first came across artificial intelligence in the form of a chatbot. Is everybody here familiar with chatbots? So a friend of mine, Rollo Carpenter, was developing a chatbot called Jabberwacky. And it's just been purchased, I believe, by Apple some 20-odd years later. And the point at which I started engaging with the chatbot, I thought, wow, this is incredible. So this learning AI could have incredible applications, say, for example, for people who are socially isolated or for kids with learning difficulties or on the spectrum. And then almost simultaneously, I thought, or maybe not, maybe this could be the worst thing that they could possibly do and it would reinforce negative behaviors. And that's the point at which I really realized that nothing in my study of psychology up to that point in time really equipped me to understand the impact of technology on humans. So I began to look around at the literature, and in the early 2000s, I came across cyber psychology. And for me, it was one of those, eureka moments. I thought, this is it, this is the future. And everybody told me I was wrong. So this is almost 20 years ago, and everybody said, no, cyber hocus pocus, it'll never come to anything, it'll never last. And here we are, and it's now a very important discipline. It's a part of applied psychology, and really can deliver explanatory value, illuminating that intersection between humans and technology, or as law enforcement say, where humans and technology collide.
Okay. So I want to talk about your formal education. And again, there's quite a list of the qualifications you have. So you have a Master's of Science in Cyber Psychology, a PhD in Forensic Cyber Psychology. You also have fellowships in Cyber Psychology, Information and Communication Technology, Network Science, and Criminology. So how important was this formal education in getting you to where you are today?
I think it's been invaluable. I mean, there's a great saying by Henry Ford. He says that you should always learn throughout life, whether you're 20 or 80, and that the very act of learning keeps you young. For me, cyber psychology had this, you know, fantastic ability to deliver insights. So if we think about HCI, which is human-computer interaction, which actually informs a lot of tech development, that's the human, and I'm being simplistic here, but in terms of how fast the screen scrolls or the size of your thumbs, the human is so much more than that. We need to really focus on motivational, affective, developmental, psychological, physiological, cognitive process to get the entire spectrum of behavior. So while I was doing my master's, I was thinking about the doctoral area, and I went back to my early love of forensics. I remember when I did my forensic psychology postgrad, the lecturer stood up in the room, and the first line that he said in the lecture was, in forensic psychology, we have an expression that if you want to live a long and healthy life, then you should change your next of kin frequently. So I loved that. I thought it was captivating. And then I combined that with cyber psychology and then focused in my doctoral research on forensic cyber psychology. And after that, I really began to realize the importance of a transdisciplinary approach. So I shifted. I had my fellowship in cyber psychology, and then I did a fellowship in network science at the IBM Center, and then I did a fellowship in criminology, and then I was awarded a fellowship in information communication technology. So the importance of stepping outside your comfort zone and the importance of not having a myopic view of the problem space and actually articulating it through multiple disciplines, for me, has really helped in terms of problem solving. And at this moment in time, just at this moment in time, I'm probably the most qualified person in the space just at this moment in time. There are others coming through, but I suppose because I saw it first academically, I managed to get there first.
And we're facing a huge cybersecurity skills gap at the moment, and there's been a lot of discussion around how important formal education certificates are in relation to passion and natural aptitude for the subject. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I think one of the problems is that we don't have formal metrics to actually look at information, to look at specifically at technology skills. So we have IQ. So IQ, intelligence quotient, is a 100-year-old measure. So if you want to measure speed of processing using a standard IQ test, you give somebody a sheet of paper and a grid with 100 blank squares, and then you give them a pencil, and they have to put a pencil mark in each of the 100 squares as fast as possible. So in an age of technology, we really, any speed of processing test at a formal IQ level needs to be a keyboard and a mouse and something to do with the actual technology. So we have IQ, we have CQ, creative quotient, and we have EQ, emotional quotient. And in a research project that I've just completed for Europol, and a research project that I'll be going on to work on, we're looking at actually formally creating a TQ, a technology quotient scale, or informing the development. Creating a scale is a major piece of work and will take many years, but to begin the process of a technology quotient scale. Now, if we could measure TQ, or latent ability in terms of technology, or innate ability in terms of technology, then at school entry age, we could spot those kids who have those skill sets. Then we could nurture and mentor them through the educational process. And by the time they come to college, we will know, we will have created a pipeline into computer science and ultimately a pipeline into the cybersecurity sector. And this would also be a very positive countermeasure to young kids getting involved in what I describe as cyber juvenile delinquency, for example, hacking. So if those skills could be recognized, reinforced, rewarded within the educational system from an early age, then there may be less of an incentive to go outside of that and seek approval and self-esteem from your peer group in terms of young kids getting involved in groups online who are engaging in hacking and criminal behavior.
And at the beginning in the introduction, I listed so many roles that you have and what you do. What do you actually consider to be your day job, though, and how would you describe that?
I don't really have a day job. I'm a slacker. I think they call it going plural. So what I do is lots of things simultaneously. So my work at Europol is research-based. It's an advisor to the EC3, the cybercrime unit there. My work at Interpol is working with the specialist group for crimes against children. My work in research at UCD and Middlesex is actually looking at working on research projects. At the moment, I'm on a book tour promoting the book, which is a lot of fun because you're getting to speak to different audiences in different countries. I've just come back from Norway, where I was speaking at a conference that was held in a fjord in Norway. So I had never been to Norway to do the conference. The funny thing was that Newsnight actually wanted me to comment on the Facebook moderator piece, and they tracked me down to this fjord in Norway, and they said, could you do a live feed from there? So I was in my bedroom in the hotel trying to figure out how to set up the live feed. So I took my computer and I balanced it on top of a waste paper basket on top of a desk, and I was pulling curtains and I was trying to get the right light so I could do it by Skype and they could record it for broadcast on BBC. And they came on to do the test and they were like, oh, we don't know about the lighting, can you move the computer? And I said, look, it's on a desk that is fixed to the wall on a waste paper basket, so this is as good as it gets. Anyway, we managed to struggle through and do the interview. So, and I'm going to China at the end of the year. So my book, the rights to my book, The Cyber Effect, which is basically an opportunity for me, shortly after the CSI series was commissioned, William Morris, the agents asked me, they approached me and they said, could I write a popular book? So I spoke to them about it and I said, well, what does popular book mean? And they said, I mean, I've written lots of academic papers and academic chapters, so I wasn't sure about a popular book. And they said, a popular book is shorter sentences and less references. And I was like, well, I probably could do that. So I wrote the book and it's now on sale in over 100 different countries worldwide. But what I'm really thrilled about is that China has bought the rights to the book. And, you know, China doesn't traditionally buy tech books. And effectively, so is Korea and Japan and Taiwan. And I go there on tour at the end of the year to actually talk about the things that I've raised in the book. So the book is about the impact of technology on humankind. I start with infants, and I go all the way through seniors, and I cover lots of topics, everything from cyberchondria through to deep web and dark nets. And effectively, I wrote the book to actually write down everything that I was worried about. So from a law enforcement perspective, I see the worst that the net has to offer. And I wanted a chance to actually write it down and start a conversation about it with a view to fixing what's wrong. So effectively, when I wrote the book, I got an opportunity to download everything. I felt much better. Everybody else was traumatized. But the book is out there, and I think it's a great starting point for a conversation. I'm absolutely pro-technology. I could not do my job as a cyber psychologist without spending an inordinate amount of my time online. In fact, I once sat the internet addiction scale test, and I got a top score in it. So the point is that technology in itself is not good or bad. It is either used well or poorly by humans. And I firmly believe that there are technology solutions to technology-facilitated problem behaviors online.
And I am myself currently being traumatized by reading that book. But,
oh, you say the nicest things.
But as we said backstage, I'm really enjoying it, and I find it absolutely fascinating. What lesson, if you could pick one lesson that you'd like readers to take out of it so that when they finish the book, they walk away with one message, what would you like that to be?
That's a good question. I when I was writing the book, I got a call from somebody who said that Bob Woodward had asked to meet me, and I was in Washington working with the researchers, and I thought, like, Bob Woodward, Watergate Bob Woodward, and they said, yeah, Bob would like you to come to his house for dinner. So I was like, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. So I went to his house, and there were five people at the dinner, and Bob literally interrogated me for 3 hours. I didn't even get a chance to eat. He asked me about the different chapters in the book and what I was doing. And he asked that question. He said, what's the one thing, the common theme throughout the book, the one big takeaway? And I said to him, actually, I don't know. I'm just on chapter 7, so I haven't had a chance to really sit back and reflect and think, well, what's the central message of the book? And Bob, being the brilliant man and the brilliant mind that he has, he said, I know what it is. And he said, it's all about control and the fact that we're losing control. So whether it's infants with smartphones and iPads, or whether it's young kids engaging in cyberbullying, or whether it's trolling, or whether it's problems with online dating, or whether it's cybersecurity issues in terms of hacking attacks, basically, it all comes down to a basic premise in society of control. And where does control lie? And how much control do we want to exercise over technology? Or how much do we want technology to control us?
In your answer to your previous question, you touched on being pro-technology and the uses for technology. And I know you have some strong opinions on government use of technology, encryption, backdoors. Do you want to talk us through your opinions on that? Because it's obviously very topical at the moment.
Yeah, certainly. I think the most important thing to recognize about technology is that if we think of the real world, where we are and we're here, now let's start thinking about cyber as an environment. Let's think about cyberspace as an environment. And the point at which NATO in 2016 declared cyberspace a domain of operations, a domain of war, it absolutely supports what people like me, cyber psychologists, have been saying for almost, you know, two decades, that cyberspace is a place. It is an environment that impacts on human behavior. So I've been involved in a dozen different research silos, everything from cyberchondria, which is a form of hypochondria manifested online, right through to organized cybercrime. And the one thing that I've observed is that whenever technology interfaces with a base human disposition, the result is amplified and accelerated online. And in the book, I describe it as the E equals MC squared of this century, this effect, this cyber effect. And I think if we could understand the mathematical configuration of that effect, we could actually move towards de-escalation. And I think that would be an incredible breakthrough. In terms of cyberspace as an environment, so let's think of it then as a continuum, as a space. On the far left, we have the keyboard warriors. We have the hands off the internet. This is our space, and this premise of frontierialism that we shouldn't have any governance. And that's based on a sort of an idealism that comes with the whole evolution of the internet. And then on the far right, we have industry. And effectively, they also want less governance because governance costs money. So their motive is one of profit. But the rest of us, the 99.9% of us and our children, we get to live in the middle and not have any say in the space. So a friend of mine who works at Interpol, Mick Moran, who is one of the directors there, has said that we're facing a tsunami of criminality coming at us down the line online. And really, we're going to have to think about governance in this space. And I know people feel very uncomfortable about it, but if we do not have some form of governance in cyber contexts, that will negatively impact on real-world social order. So effectively, let's think of it as three silos, three aims. There are three aims that are in apparent conflict. You have an aim of privacy, an aim of collective security, and an aim of the vitality of the tech industry. And to achieve a balance in cyberspace, none of those aims can have primacy over the other. So the vitality of the tech industry cannot dominate collective security or privacy. And privacy cannot dominate the other two. And I get very concerned, and this is the encryption debate, effectively, and I know it's a hot topic, but just as a general principle in terms of social order, I get very concerned from a policing and governance point of view when there are encrypted domains that are effectively beyond the law or not within easy and timely capacity of policing and the law to access. And the point of that about that is it will be almost impossible real time to deliver on collective security when this information is obfuscated. So I think the real challenge, I don't want to be prescriptive and say this is what we should do. What I want to do is have a conversation, stop thinking in silos, cybersecurity over here and child development over here, social order somewhere here, and actually start joining the dots. And that's what I tried to do in my book. I said, look, it's all connected. So we can't look at any one problem in isolation. Hackers don't wake up at 15 and decide to become a hacker. There's a developmental pathway into hacking. If we can understand that and address that early on, then we can start tackling that problem over time. So I think, you know, the UK actually is showing incredible leadership in this space. Incredible leadership in terms of, for example, access to online pornography, which is very, very damaging for young people, and actually looking at age verification online. Age verification is critical in terms of child protection. There is no shallow end of the swimming pool online. Kids are being subjected to content that they should never see. And while everybody sitting here may say, well, that's not my problem, I don't have kids, are there only kids? These kids will come in time, will begin to shape society. And when we're all sitting in some sort of nursing home, they're the ones who are going to be running the country. They may not have levels of empathy that are actually conducive to looking after everybody else.
But if you bring that technology to within the law, I think you're talking about it being outside of the law at the moment, and you do put those backdoors in, there's obviously a concern that it's not just the government and the defense agencies that are going to use those, and it perhaps opens up, well, it does open up the doors to the cyber criminals too and the bad guys. So where do you sit on that?
I think that's the crux of the debate. And again, I'm not going to be prescriptive and say this is definitively what mm-hmm. we have to do. What I'm saying is there has to be checks and balances. And effectively, if we see an increasing amount of negative behavior associated with wide use of encryption across social media platforms, for example, and that's got a negative impact, then we're going to have to think about it again. But it may be that banking or business transactions, that encryption should be robust there. What I'm saying is that we need to have a conversation. In fact, in the US, the House there has just passed a bill, and this is really interesting, which is going to actually result in a 15-year jail sentence for teens who are caught sexting. 15 years prison time. You're a 15-year-old boy and you send an image to your girlfriend, 15 years. And that is so draconian. And in fact, I'm going to be speaking on it in the US soon. And what I want to know is, what sentence is the app developer going to get? The one that created the app that allowed the encrypted image to be sent, what's their jail time? Because we can't just take it out on the kids. There is a collective responsibility in terms of behavior of youth online. And if we have kids who've grown up with almost unrestricted access to adult pornography, who've grown up in a hyper-sexualized society, and who are given applications that allow them to send explicit images, is that the fault of the child, or is that a collective responsibility? And the point about sexual curiosity is that it's normative. I mean, back in the day, we went behind the cow shed and played strip poker or spin the bottle. What we didn't do was take digital images and widely disseminate them. So the behavior is normative, just the technology is facilitating it on a different level. The problem with sexting is that it's viewed through the lens of the child pornography legislation. In other words, if you are under 18 and if the image is explicit, then you are generating and distributing child pornography, albeit of yourself. And now we're going to prosecute these kids? So I think they're the sort of issues that we need to discuss.
And by the way, we will have an opportunity to take some questions from the audience at the end of the session. So if you do have any for Mary, you will have the opportunity. I'd like to touch briefly on your work with Europol and your work as an advisor to EC3. What capacity do you have in that role, and what have you been able to influence?
I think, well, first of all, I'm not law enforcement. I'm not a police officer, but I certainly, as an academic, advise and support the work they do. So I don't work frontline crimes. I work in sort of the higher level architectures or typologies that inform the classification of criminal behavior. So for example, we have stalking as a real world phenomenon. So what about stalking? Stalking is typically male behavior. Typically this is real world stalking. Typically there's one victim. And the motive to engage in stalking is that glimpse of intimacy into the life of the victim, which means a lot of walking around and hiding in the bushes and waiting until that minute that the curtains are being closed. So very labor intensive. And then you have cyber stalking. So cyber stalking is stalking mediated by technology. But the behavior changes because a cyber stalker can stalk multiple victims simultaneously because the technology affords them the ability to do so. They can set alerts to know when their victims are online. In addition to that, we see the emergence of females in cyberstalking that we don't see in the real world. And in addition to that, in terms of motive, it's not a glimpse of intimacy, it's actually access to somebody's life, their photos, their diaries, their correspondence, their network, everything. So the real question is, have we been lazy by just sticking the prefix cyber in front of something? And if a criminal behavior is differentiated in three major ways, are we still talking about the same behavior, or do we need to create a new classification? So that's the sort of work that I do for Europol.
And that's a really interesting point, actually, how gender behavior changes when you move from the real world into the cyber world. Why do you think that is?
In terms of, well, it could be that women would actually like, in a real-world context, to stalk, say, for example, their ex-boyfriend, but they place themselves at considerable risk in terms of following him around, pub to pub, and therefore the technology makes it easier. So it could be that it just facilitates behavior that is already there, but real-world sort of restricts it. Or it could be that there is this amplification and escalation. I'll give you an example. I don't know if anybody in the audience engages in online dating. No? Yes? Sometimes? So without spoiling the weekend, I'm going to give you some stats, recent stats about online dating. The NCA have reported a 600% increase in sexual assault and rape associated with online dating. And 71% of those assaults take place on the first date in the victim or the offender's home. And when the NCA, the National Crime Agency here, conducted research into this, and I was involved in disseminating the information on Crime Watch for the BBC, what they found was that online can be a very lean medium, almost like stranger on the train syndrome, where you can actually disclose a lot of personal information because you don't have those face-to-face visual cues. And as well as that, you can have hyper-personal interaction. What does that mean? It means that you can move from chatting to, like, you know, what movies do you like, to what's your pet's name, to talking about hyper-sexualized content very quickly. So by the time the date happens, the NCA call it misdirected expectations in terms of what's going to happen, in terms of the previous sexualized content. To be clear, a sexual assault is a crime, a sexual assault without consent. But what's fascinating from a behavioral point of view is the offenders that the NCA have actually tracked and analyzed do not have a typical sex offender profile. in that they're not known to law enforcement and they don't have any previous convictions or history. And that's a classic example of behavior mutating in a cyber context and creating that problem.
Okay, so we're getting through time very quickly, so I'm conscious of wanting to ask you lots of questions. So let's try these next few as quick fire.
Okay.
What is the thing in your very impressive career that you're most proud of?
I think the book. You know, I wrote a popular book, which is high risk for an academic. When I was asked to write the popular book, one academic said to me, "Oh dear God, Mary, many a fine career, academic career, has been ruined by a popular book." So my book was Nature International Journal Book of the Year, Sunday Times Book of the Year. So here's to ruining an academic career.
Okay, and so on the flip side of that, what's your biggest professional regret?
I actually don't have any regrets because fundamentally I don't believe in regret as a principle. The point about regret is it's to do with decision making. So if you make a decision and you have all the variables that you know at that point of time at your disposal and you make a decision based on those, and in hindsight, after the fact, it turned out that there was something else, well, then that is regret, but it's not constructive in terms of decision making. So if you're making a decision and it turns out to be a bad decision, then ask yourself, at the time I made the decision, was I under the influence of Class A drugs? Was I sober? Was I of sound mind? And if you can say yes to all of those three things, then stick by your decision and don't engage in regret. It's easy after the fact to regret things, but it's terrible to second guess your own decision making. So own it, move forward, and always make decisions with the information that you have at any given point of time. Move on.
Okay. Give us an as yet unfulfilled ambition.
I'd like to make a documentary.
Okay.
So having done the TV show, I'd like to make a documentary. I think that could be fun. At this stage in my career, I think I'd like to make a documentary of the book. I'm talking to a couple of different companies about it, and I think that would be really interesting. I get bored easily, so I like to actually just engage in new challenges.
Okay. So I think one thing we probably all want to know about is the CSI Cyber program. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
I was actually working on a research project for the White House. I was recruited to work with some network scientists at MIT on technology solutions to technology facilitated problem behavior. And there was some media coverage of the event. And the next thing, I got a call from William Morris, who I actually thought was the cigarette company, because I'm not in the entertainment business. And they said, look, some people in Hollywood would like to meet you and talk about cyber psychology. And I sort of said, no, they wouldn't. You know, they're not going to be interested. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I'm going to write a book called How to Get Ahead in Hollywood by Doing Everything Wrong, because I did everything wrong. I wasn't available. I was too busy. I didn't want to do it. And it still happened. I turned up for a 15-minute interview with a person that I thought was an intern called Nina at CBS, and it turned out to be the president. The 15-minute interview turned into 3 hours. There were six of them, grilled me. And they literally stood up in the room and they said, we'd like to make a TV show based on your work. And I said to them, can I get back to you? I didn't expect it. Anyway, look, it was fun. Patricia Arquette actually played me in the show, which is as surreal as it sounds. I will never get used to writing down words and seeing it come out of her mouth on television. But look, it was 33 episodes, a fantastic experience. I enjoyed every minute of it, and actually when they commissioned the show, it was sort of a life rights deal, but when I started going to Los Angeles to work in it, the first thing I did was I went to casting, and I said, who are you going to cast as me? And I said, you know, please, you know, have somebody that when you look into her eyes, it could be the window to her brain. And then I went to the wardrobe department, and I said, please don't put her in a dress and get her to wear black. And they were like, why is that? And I said, well, I'm a behavioral profiler. So why would I hemorrhage data at 50 paces? Why would I wear a yellow blouse so that I'm looking optimistic, or pink because I'm vulnerable, or a pattern to look interesting? Sorry.
Do I look interesting?
So basically, you know, it was a lot of fun. And then I went to the special effects because it was a theoretical construct that I was trying to show about information between hidden between a blinds, which was Gestalt theory of good continuation. And they were messing it up, so I went down to do that. And the next thing, I got a call from the producers, and they called me in. And they said, we hear you've been to casting, we hear you've been to wardrobe, we hear you've been into special effects. And I said, well, I'm just trying to help. And they said, well, actually, now we're going to change your deal. And I thought, oh, God, here's where I get fired for, like, interfering. And they said, no, we're going to make you a producer on the show, which technically means I get points and stuff. And I said to them, oh, look, thanks, but no thanks. And they said, is that a negotiating strategy? And I said, no, I just don't have that sort of money. And they said, no, we're not asking for your money. We're trying to give you more money. And I was like, okay, that's okay. I mean, each episode cost $5 million to make. It's like an incredible, incredible. But the important thing, it was an incredible opportunity for me to actually inform and educate in terms of cybersecurity and awareness. And the series aired in 170 countries. So it was a privilege to be involved with Hollywood.
Yeah, it's amazing. We've got 5 minutes left, so if anybody in the audience has any questions, we could take those now. Can we come to this gentleman first, please?
Just a curiosity, actually. recently, a major UK technology company found two of its employees who are actually at the pinnacle of the organization. So they were the most trusted employees in their Italian operation. Two guys at the very top of the organization in Italy were found to be stealing hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay.
And this was only found out accidentally. I was just wondering how many of the gatekeepers themselves, I mean, how often is it that gatekeepers themselves are actually the criminal element? I mean, how difficult is that issue? Because so many of the people who are apparently gatekeepers turn out to be actually moonlighting.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. Criminal behavior can take place at any level in the organization, and you would hope that there would be checks and balances within the system, like a board of directors and non-execs that would pick up on that sort of behavior before it came to the point that they were taking funds out of the company on that scale. But, you know, we have a thing called cyber slacking. And cyber slacking is when people check their Facebook and check their, you know, social media and effectively are cheating the company of their time. Cyber slacking is most prevalent at the upper management levels of companies, which is sort of counterintuitive. Yes?
A fascinating talk, and congratulations on your induction.
Thank you.
A futuristic question for you. Mm-hmm. So the bad actions you talked about today are done by humans. Have you had a thought about what happens when the bad actions are done by AI?
That's a really interesting question. And I think that I get very concerned when I see search moving from basic AI towards deep learning. And even the engineers who work in search, and we won't name specific companies, but effectively they admit that they will lose control of the process. So if we think about artificial intelligence, and in fact, I'm getting involved in a startup entity with a professor of artificial intelligence, where we're actually we're creating our own startup, and we're just talking to funders at the moment, where we're going to look at new mathematical theories to inform algorithms, to inform AI technologies in terms of actually making sure that the human stays at the center of the process. So if you think about artificial intelligence, it's a circular definition in that it's trying to mimic human intelligence, but effectively, as behavioral scientists, we barely understand how the human brain works, so to try and make an intelligence that mimics or replaces that is sort of a false premise. I prefer to look at, instead of AI, IA, which is intelligence amplification, which is the work of Licklider. And Licklider wrote a paper in 1960 called Man-Computer Symbiosis, where artificial intelligence and humans, his prediction was that we would need to have a symbiotic relationship, so a relationship that was mutually beneficial. And I think if we look at the explosion in investment in AI now, it's going through another sort of investment, peaking of investment, I think the really interesting questions to crack in artificial intelligence will be how we can actually use artificial intelligence to augment cognitive processes in humans that are not understood in terms of behavioral science. So, for example, insight and intuition. And that's the area I'm going to be working in. But whatever I do in terms of artificial intelligence or however I get involved in it, I will ensure that the human always stays at the center of the process, because the point at which we shift over and allow AI to dominate, then that's going to be a problem for us. And I'll just give you one example of a particular, giving artificial intelligence a particular human problem. So you could say to an AI, effectively, I want you to find, or the machine, to find a cure for cancer. So the AI could go off and search the internet, and a learning AI, and learn everything about cancer. Everything. Look at every academic journal, look at every blood test and biopsy and report. And the AI would come back and say, I have a 100% cure for cancer. So that's really interesting. The cure would be to kill every human. The point at which you kill every human, you have a perfect cure for cancer. So that's how artificial intelligence operates. What's the optimum cure? But that's not how humans work.
Thank you. We do have more questions, but unfortunately we have run out of time. But Mary is going straight from here to her book signing, which is taking place in the networking lounge. I'm sure you'd be willing to have conversations
sure.
and answer any more questions then.
And I just want to leave you with one thought, something to go home and think about. You know, when we talk about the internet and we talk about negative behavior, there's a causation correlation model. Does technology cause bad behavior? And this connectivity that it has delivered, the one, you know, one way of thinking is it's causing? I don't think so. The other way of thinking about it is that, in fact, what it is doing, the connectivity in the internet and the manifestation of behavior, is it's shining a very bright light into the darkest reaches of the human psyche, what Jung called the 2-million-year-old man. And my concern is that maybe we're all just Game of Thrones underneath it all. Thank you.
So all that leaves me to do is to formally induct Professor Mary Akin into the Hall of Fame. We have some champagne and a lovely pen for you. And of course, your certificate. So I think Vicky is going to join us on stage for a quick photograph.
Okay, thank you.
There you go. Do you want us in front of the front of the table? In front of the keynote, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
Mary.
For your time. Thank you.
Thank
and
you.
Anybody wants to come in and have a chat or get a copy of the book, come in and see me. Okay.